That was fantastic. And I have to say, I'm really happy I don't have to follow that. Please welcome our second speaker, Bonnie V, a member of the Atlantic Group in Manhattan.
Hi, I'm Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank this committee. This is an honor. This is a privilege. And it's a moment in my sobriety and in my life that is a humbling experience, so thank you. You know, when my husband actually got the phone call to say that I was speaking, my first thought was, oh, I must be the backup, you know, and that's, of course, my thinking. And so I was kind of taken aback. And I realized in the next moment, the thought was, there's some kind of purpose and there's something that I'm supposed to do. So I just once again want to say thank you. Just a couple of pertinent facts about myself. My sobriety date is June 24th, 1988. My home group is the Atlantic Group. And my sponsor is the beautiful Myra, who is here tonight. And her sponsor is Francine, who is here tonight. And her sponsor is Peggy B., who is here tonight. All right, so sit back, relax, because it's going to be a bumpy night. My first resentment was at the age of 3. Didn't know I was an alcoholic, but I definitely had a resentment. My parents, now there's going to be a theme here, so keep in line. My first resentment was at 3, and my parents went on a cruise, and they didn't take me. And I remember I was with Zadie and Grandma and Uncle Al, and I was at their in their apartment. And back then it was 1963, so you can all figure out the numbers, and I looked damn good. I could say that myself. And then my grandma was at the phone, and she was trying to coax me to come to the phone, and I was, like, standing there, stamping my feet in the middle of the living room, going, no, they didn't take me. I'm not going to talk to her. Now, at the age of 3, that could have been probably funny, but at the age of 33, with a whole lot of other resentment stuffed in my Louis Vuitton bag, schlepping them around, it wasn't funny. And let me tell you, I had a lot. I picked up my first drink at the age of 9. I have 2 nieces. One who's 7 and one who's 14. 9 is a very young age. And my first drink was at the age of 9. I had no idea I liked the taste, and it tasted good. I also have to say that I grew up in Queens, and my parents' best friend was named Seymour. He was an interior decorator. And he decorated everybody's home like a bar. So when you came in, you had that bar atmosphere. So I knew all the drinks. I was very cool. I knew what the Rusty Nails was and the White Russians, and I just was, you know, overdone with myself. And I remember we were at, Lauren's going to remember this, we were at Susan's house. Oh, Susan's parents used to go away. And we were all at Susan's house, and I got drunk. And I was the only one who got drunk and blacked out and had to get picked up. And my punishment, and God bless my parents, they didn't know what alcoholism is, but my punishment was that I couldn't use the phone. So for 2 weeks, I had no phone privileges. And, you know, if you don't know, you don't know how to treat alcoholism or an alcoholic. I believe that I had all the isms and I was just raring to go. At the age of 13, I picked up and I was a daily user until I came in here at the age of 27. And when I got here, let me tell you, I was hopeless. I wanted to die. I never thought I'd reach the age of 30, nor did I want to. Growing up, I had a lot of the outside stuff. You know, my parents sent me to the best school, you know, at the time, and I went to a private school, and whatever they could possibly get me or give me or buy me, it just was never enough, and I always wanted more. You know, I have the disease of more. Whatever it is, I want it bigger, I want it better, I want it more. And, you know, for many, many years, I, again, did not know that I had this disease. I did not know that nice Jewish girls from Queens are alcoholics. My father owned a factory down on the Lower East Side on the Bowery, and on the way coming off the Williamsburg Bridge, there were always these guys that were pretty disgusting, and, you know, they would, like, wipe the windows, and my mother was sitting in the Cadillac, you know, and, like, you know, very petrified, like, you know, like, close the buttons on the door, you know, don't let them in. And that, to me, was the alcoholic. I didn't know that I could have this disease. And so as I went along my journey and I was using and abusing, my disease kind of progressed, and I didn't know it. And so I left, and I went on to college, and, you know, it was always about having the outsides. And I remember studying theater in London, and all I remember about studying theater in London was Harvey's Bristol Cream with a twist. That's all I had. Harvey's Bristol Cream with a twist. Is that your water? Can I have it? Where? Oh, great. Thanks. Sorry. Okay. Harvey's Bristol Cream with a twist. And I constantly did not know that this was a problem. And the person that I went out with at the time would say to me, do you really have to drink that? Do you really have to do that? And I didn't know that I didn't have to, and so he fell by the wayside, which is usually what I did. If you did not party the way I did, you were out. End of conversation. On to the next. I didn't want to waste my time. Either you drank like I did, and you partied like I did, or we were on to the next. And so when I graduated college, I always wanted to be a movie star, so my first job out of college was a waitress. And I always knew the hip, slick, cool places to waitress in. And my best friend was always the bartender. And I always knew where to get things and how to get things. And it was, this is a party town. And again, I did not know that I had a problem. But it started to become apparent to those around me that I did. And this is where it gets pretty personal. There are people that are here tonight that I really owe a debt of gratitude, and they're very meaningful in my life. And I want to thank Lauren and Steve and Harriet and Irwin for showing up, for coming in from Connecticut and New Jersey, and because these are important people in my life. This is part of how I got here. These are the people that started noticing that I had a problem. I remember the first intervention that I had was in 1985, and Lauren called up a girlfriend of mine, and she said, you know, something needs to be done or whatever. And I'll never forget, it was 9 o'clock in the morning. They asked me to come to their house in Manhattan, and I was like too through. I was like, what's that important that I have to show up at 9 a.m. because that was, you know, really too much for me to do. And I showed up at 9 in the morning, and they were like, you know, we're concerned about you. And of course, you know, being the good alcoholic with the attitude, I was like, look, you don't pay my rent. You know, I'm like, I don't know what your problem is. I don't have a problem. I'm having a good time. That's it. And, you know, that Lauren didn't leave me. You know, she continued to be my friend, and she was getting married. And as a good alcoholic that I was envious, I was jealous, I was discontent. I was like, oh, I'm so happy for you. What about me and where's mine? But so it was at an engagement party. My memory's not that great. engagement party, or maybe it was a shower. And thank God my mother brought the present. I couldn't remember to bring one. I was too busy. And her mom came up to me, and I'll never forget this moment. It came up to me in a very loving way and said, you know, if you ever want to come to a meeting with me, you can. You know, there are young people there. And, of course, I had the bravado, and I was like, oh, well, I don't have a problem, and and she didn't push the issue. Needless to say, a few months later, when I was in the wedding party and blacked out, and my parents told me that I had taken a nap, which is always something that you do at a wedding, is take a nap, I proceeded to wake up after the blackout, take home the centerpiece, which was important, and kiss everybody and tell them I had a fabulous time. I started to realize that I had a problem, and it was January of 1988. Now, I did not come in here until June of 88, and from January 1st, 88, to June of 88 was my living nightmare. I'm sure each and every one of you has that memory of what it was for you. For 6 months, I knew I had a problem and I had no way out. And I was scared. And I finally realized that I had to do something about it. And I made a phone call to my parents. And once again, they were going on a cruise. And they said, look, we're going on a cruise. You know, and my father said, Bubby, you know, could it wait 2 weeks? We're going on a cruise. And I said, no, it can't because I'm going to be dead. And, of course, my father thought I was being a drama queen, but for the first time in my life, I was telling the truth. And I went to a detox, and then they shipped me off, and they shipped me off to Hazleton, which is a rehab out in Minnesota. And I stayed out there, and I went to a halfway house, and I stayed out there for 9 months. And I was scared to death to come back here because I had burnt a lot of bridges. And when I got back, I knew I needed to make meetings, and so I did that. Is this mine? And so I got a home group, and I made meetings, and I did service. I was my first service commitment was a cookie commitment, and I loved it. And I would go to that meeting religiously. And I was in another fellowship, and after 4 years, I kept saying, you know, I'm just, something's not right. I don't know what it is. I just don't know what it is. Something's not right. And I went, oh, I know what it is. I need a boyfriend. I need a boyfriend. And so, you know, I found one, and two halves don't make a whole. God bless that person. But I got a boyfriend. And you know what? I was still restless, irritable, and discontented. But I wasn't drinking, and I was sober. But I was miserable, and I was slowly dying. And I didn't know why. And finally, I was at a gym that I couldn't afford, but it was a place to be. And and I opened up a meeting list. And next to the meeting list, and this is for those who are new or don't know, you know, what this is. Next to the meeting list, the meeting that I chose, it said BB. Close to 5 years of sobriety, I had no idea what BB stood for. BB stands for Big Book. So I went to the meeting, and I thought, well, it's kind of close to me. I could take the R train home. This will work. And I went to the meeting, and as a friend of mine said, I was wrapped around a pole pretty tight. And I proceeded to talk about myself, and then I thought, well, I guess I should get a sponsor or something. And I walked over to a woman, and she had everything that I wanted. She was coiffed. You know, her nails were done. She looked good. And she said to me, well, I can't sponsor you because I haven't done the work, but this other woman can. And I was like, oh, all right. So I walk over to this other woman, and she gives me her phone number, and she said, look, why don't you call me tomorrow night? And I was thinking, tomorrow night? Tomorrow night? It's Friday. It's date night. Obviously, she doesn't have a date, so I'll grace her with my presence. I'll call. Fine. Okay. And I called her. And I proceeded to talk about myself as usual. And she said, look, I'm going to Florida, and you're an actress, right? I said, yeah. She goes, so you can read the big book. Of course I can. You know. So she said, good. Why don't you read the first 163 pages and call me back after I get back? And I thought, okay. So she gets back from the weekend. I call her up. I read maybe the first 50 pages. Let me tell you, kind of boring. You know, I was like, no, please. And so she's on the phone with me, and she goes, well, did you do the work? And I said, well, I read 50 pages. And she said, when you finished reading it, call me. Click. I was too through. Doesn't she know who I am? You know, God does for me what I can't do for myself. I chased that woman for the next 2 years of my sobriety, and I'm always grateful to her because she brought me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which brought me a bridge back to life because I was dying. And I take this disease very, very seriously. My sponsor tells me, don't take yourself too seriously. Rule number 62. But this disease I take seriously. And so I went through the steps, and she asked me one thing, if I'd make her a promise. And she said, would you give to others what was freely given to yourself? And I said, of course. I should have given her money. It would have been easier. I then eventually went to my present home group after a couple of years. I had my ninth year of sobriety, and I moved over to the Atlantic group because they had what I wanted, and there was a lot of structure. And I got my sponsor, my present sponsor, Myra. And what was going on was that I had the big book up here, but I didn't have it in my heart. You know, I can spew the pages and la-la-la-la-la, but, you know, it's coming from the heart. And I started Sponsor of the Women, and my life started to change. You know, this is an amazing program. You know, it's a program that works in rough going. They say that in the book. You know, life on life's terms. Just like the previous speaker said, life on life's terms. You know, you got good days and you get bad days. You know, and drinking is not an option today. It is just not an option. Because if I pick up, everything goes. Everything. There ain't no half measures. Everything goes. I got a really good life today. I have a really good life. You know, they say beyond your wildest dreams. I don't know if it's beyond my wildest dreams. I'm living a lot of my dreams. I'm in a really, well, I should hope, I think, it's a good marriage. I don't know. You'll have to ask my husband later on tonight. Well, he's sitting at the dais. Of course he's going to say yes. You know? I have... obviously, the people that showed up for me here tonight. I have true friends in my life. I work in a career that I love, and I try to the best of my ability to be a woman of dignity and honor. Doesn't work all the time, not 100% all the time. I have to kind of be present. And, you know, this month, and I'll just share with you this month alone. This month was a busy month. It was a busy, busy month. Right after I got the phone call to say that I was going to speak, my mother has Alzheimer's, and her home care worker at night, the nighttime shift, said, oh, I you have 4 days notice. In 4 days, I'm having another job. And my first gut reaction was to go down there and, you know, fix everything, which, you know, I'm powerless and I can't fix everything and I can't control things. So I knew I need to put that on hold. And I also was, my husband turned 50 and I was throwing him a surprise birthday party and I was having that in my home for, you know, 45 people and, you know, and then, you know, I got a job. You know, my agent called me, and, you know, I'm working. And it was just kind of like busy. And through all of that, a day at a time, I get to show up. Still make meetings, still call my sponsor. Not so perfectly, but still call my sponsor. And on a daily basis, I get to do that. Because first and foremost, I am an alcoholic, and I can't forget that. Not so important that other people know, because I don't share that a lot. But it's important that I know what I need to do to stay sober. You know, and it was a very busy month, and incorporating in that was speaking here. Right now, you know, there are people in Florida, my mother included, that are sitting in a blackout. And what I wanted to do was go down there. But I can't blow off the speaking commitment. I need to be here. So, you know, after this, I will be going down there because she's going to be moving on in her life. And they're with me here tonight, my parents. My father, you know, one of the things that I, you know, it says we will not regret the past. I never got to make an eyeball-to-eyeball amends to my father. But I did... to his grave, and I said that I would be the daughter to his wife, and I would be the aunt to his granddaughter, and the sister, you know, to his sons. You know, and at a day at a time, I get to do that. and I get to show up. And this is such an amazing program. We get to show up for others. We get to show up for life. And I can't even begin to tell you where I might be if it wasn't for this program. I think I know because my cousin Marcia is there. In August, my husband and I were at her unveiling. You know, 52 and could not or would not or didn't get the message for whatever reason. Why I'm here and somebody else isn't, I don't know. All I know is what I need to do to stay sober a day at a time. And for that, I am very grateful, very honored, and I want to thank you.
Thanks so much, Bonnie. I'm very happy you didn't go to Florida. You know? Thank you. And now I'd like to welcome our third speaker, George T., a member of the Saturday Morning Big Book Discussion Group, Brooklyn.
Good evening. I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George. You know, when I made my first Bill W. dance, I think it was a dollar. No. It was $25, and I had about less than a year recovery, sobriety. And I remember saying to myself, I should be up there speaking. You know, because the old timers allowed you to have a big ego when I came in. They didn't criticize you. So 29 years later, here I am. My higher power said... My higher power said, that boy, I need to get him some humility before I let him get up there. But I like to say to people that are visiting and people that are new, this is not alcoholism out there. This is recovery. If you don't believe me, let us all take a drink, and the SWAT team would be here in about an hour and a half turning out this hotel. We would turn this hotel out. Believe me. What are you looking at me for? What are you looking at me? Oh, boy. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1976, I was told to go to a meeting. I remember when I was in the VA hospital, a gentleman came up who had an accent just like my friend Paul over there, and he said, we was on the, a bunch of Vietnam vets, and we was up there on the drug ward, the crazy ward, the alcoholic ward, and this guy came in with a suit on looking real nice, and he said, oh, I'd like to go to AA. And we were all playing pinochle. I said, what's he talking about, man? We're in the hospital in a locked ward. The guy said, that's for them sick people. We said, no, thanks, man. Get out of here. I had no idea. I'll just say a little bit about my drunkalogue because we all know how to drink. I just didn't know how to stop. I always like to tell about my experience in recovery. See, because I don't blame my character defects on my drinking anymore. How am I going to slap somebody and say, well, I'm an alcoholic and I drank 29 years ago. That's why I slapped you tonight. It doesn't work that way. You know. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, let me go back a little bit. I was born in Jersey City in the Bronx, and I grew up in the Bronx. Middle child. You know, I used to think, like, if I ran away from home, you know, like, they wouldn't miss me, you know. Like, you know, I was ran away. Good. Okay, sit down and have something to eat. And I didn't like to fight, so I joined the service. Isn't that amazing? You know, I'm afraid. Let me join the military. But anyway, I put 15 years in the military, and I'm not going to go into all that. But when I came out of the service in 1971, leaving my daughter and her mother due to alcoholism, and I came out here as a civilian, I was crazy as a bedbug. Believe me. And I did just like a lot of people say, I didn't know I had an alcohol problem. I had a people problem. I thought it was hate, but it was anger. I had a lot of anger. I mean, anger. You know, you walk around the streets. Anyway, it was really a mess. And I remember my mother telling me one day they was all having like a normal breakfast, you know, bacon, eggs. And I had a glass of whiskey. And my mother, that's whiskey? Yeah. What's wrong with this woman? Of course it is. But I think the saddest part about being an alcoholic is you don't know you're an alcoholic. I mean, I blame things on everything. That's why When I got to Alcoholic Anonymous in 76, I was told to go to a meeting. The guys, I wanted to get back into this halfway house, and this gentleman said, go to a meeting. And I know I must have surrendered, because I went in. And when I went to AA at that time, everybody dressed us like we're dressed now. See, because sneakers and jeans wasn't hip yet. You know, they couldn't wear sneakers at them time. You know, she would. And jeans, nobody was wearing jeans. Everybody had on suits and stuff. So I went to this meeting, and I didn't know it was an anniversary, but everybody was dressed up, and they drove up in cars. I said, man, this is great. You know, so when everybody stood up, I stood up. When they had cookies, I ate a cookie. You know, they had coffee, I drank coffee. They said the Lord's Prayer, I mumbled something. You know, but I wanted what they had. And this gentleman stood up in front of them and said, my name is Willie F.P., and I'm a grateful alcoholic. So I thought that's how you're supposed to introduce yourself. I couldn't even spell grateful. I didn't know what it meant, but what you said, I said it. And what makes me so grateful about alcohol, and I know you see people with sponsors say, you're not working your program. How could I walk in here after 25 years of drinking and work this program? No way on the planet. The old-timers knew that back then. But see, I thought I had it. So I was the guy that would go to your meeting and say, if the speaker don't show, I'll speak, okay? And they'd say, have a cup of coffee. Yeah. And they'd tell the other guy, don't ask that guy to speak. You know, let him have some coffee over there for about. And see, then they'd fool you when you came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I came out. The old timers would fool you. They'd give you that look. You know, you'd be dumping stuff in there, and I hate this person, I hate that person. They'd say, don't drink and make meetings. Yeah, but. And they would never say, well, I think you should do this. They wouldn't tell you that. But see, then they give you a title. They say, we're going to make you chairperson. And you'd say something, what is that? Oh, you're the chairperson of the group. And I belonged to Brooklyn Central at that time in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And, you know, you get it. They say, now, what you got to do is you come to the meeting, set up the coffee, set up the tables. See, they didn't have the Perkin coffee then. You're thinking back from the 1800s or something. But you poured the coffee in this big pot. Then you had to set the pitchers on each table with a cup in front of everybody. This is about 175-person meeting. Cup in front of everybody with a napkin, and the old-timers wouldn't lift a finger to help you. But they taught you, if somebody said, can I help you, you had to say yes. Now, you know, after setting up all them tables, somebody walked and said, do you need any help? You want to say, what? You know, but you said, yeah, you can put this cup over there if you want, you know. You didn't want no help. And then when you got into the kitchen, it became your kitchen, and you'd kill anybody who came in there, you know. We talk about how kind Alcoholic Anonymous is, which is true. Don't make the coffee in your group one night. And let it be cold. See, alcoholics don't walk into the AA meeting and say, have you seen Mary or Bobby? Say, is the coffee ready? That's it. No, the coffee pot, what? Who's making it, you know? And another thing about Alcoholic Anonymous that I love, I'll get to the pain in a minute, believe it, is that, you know, Pico coffee is a Spanish coffee that, you know, it's like espresso. I didn't know it was on sale, you know? So I took the whole can and poured it in the pot. And, you know, I said, boy, this is kind of powdery, but. And you could put a quart of milk in the cup and it was still black coffee. You know. And you know what they said to me? Good coffee, George. Good cup. And, you know, the funny part about it is I was extremely angry, AA, man. I mean, I stood in the back, man, growling, you know, like really controlled. I got a friend, Billy, over there who, you know, let's show you how this fellowship worked. I had 5 years when he came in, and he took me to my first retreat, you know, and it was taught to me by the old times as quality recovery, not quantity, you know, because I go to a step meeting on Sundays, like I was telling Kathy, and I have people like got a half hour talking about the step. I say, damn, I didn't know that. I mean, they be talking some heavy step stuff. Let me go back and read my step book. I must have missed something. See, because it's quality recovery. I got a coin that got 1 year on it, and I got a coin, a silver coin that a friend gave me that got 25 years on it. And you know, they both say the same thing? To the own self be true. Serenity Prayer in the back, Unity Recovery Service. Not like, oh, the 25 years, this is a different one. You know, we got some heavy stuff on this one, you know. And this gentleman, Mr. George B., he lied to me because he said when I had my 10th year, you see, I was always looking for the big AA, you know, the big, Because I knew y'all had something big once you get them two-digit numbers. So in my 10th anniversary, I went up to him. He was like a mentor to me. This was the most spiritual person I ever met. I said, Mr. Bell, I got 10 years. He said, yeah. I said, well. He said, keep doing what you're doing. I said, what? He said, don't drink and make meetings. I said, but I'm doing that. He said, well, keep doing what you're doing. In other words, he talked to me like I had 2 months. You see, now that I have 29 years, I do what I did in my first 90 days. See, I make coffee at my home group, big book discussion. You know, I go there with another guy named Jack with our age, but we said, we hope somebody young comes down, at least 50, to help us with these tables. He's the bagel cutter. I'm the coffee maker, you know. And we don't say nothing to each other. He goes in the kitchen, I come out here. But we do our service. So that's what I know when I say it old time and say I'm going back to basics. But as I'm talking, you know, Bridge to Life, I was taught by this man, Mr. George B., who passed away with 35 years. He said, if you really want to learn to live and let live, George, he said, you got to get out of your neighborhood. See, because we're raised in the same neighborhood. Everybody agrees, yeah, right, me too. We eat the same foods, right? Drink the same, right? Everybody says the same thing. He said, go listen to other AAs, share their experience, Trenton Hope. So I got on a train and crossed over that Manhattan Bridge in 1979. And this shows how, if you're new to AA, boy, you can get freaked out of here, you know. I went into this group was on 16th Street off 6th Avenue, and this beautiful woman comes and said, hi, how are you? I said, fine. She said, I'm going to give you my phone number. I said, whoa. This is good, you know, because I was still pretty sick. And she said, and this is my husband. I said, what? I said, boy, this is a good fellowship, you know. Weird, but good, you know. I didn't know they was being friendly. I came in with the thinking I had when I was out there. I didn't come in. And I followed women. Oh, I'm going to go to that meeting. Where she's at? People said, they just come here to socialize. No kidding. You take the drink from me. I didn't know how to socialize. I remember going to my first AA dance. Me and this girl, Martha, we was living like in a halfway house together. And here, like out in the street, we was like bad, you know, dancing and everything. We sit up there like this. Then we got up there and danced. We started hyperventilating. Terrified. First AA dance. You know. Didn't have that booze in me. Couldn't do nothing, you know. And I remember drinking. You see, when you talk about pain, alcoholics know about some pain, boy. I don't care if you're from Yale, Jail, Park Avenue, or Park Bench. We know some, right? Yeah. We know some pain, boy. We know some pain. You know, I don't care if you're in jeans or a suit. Don't matter. I remember, like, can you picture this? You're living with somebody, as I always did until I got sober. You know, I never had my own mailbox, you know, And you're living with these people, and you make them believe you sleep. You can't wait till they leave. You know, like, you're really wide awake. And so they finally go to work, and you're left alone in the apartment. Nobody there but you, and you're walking around softly. And don't let the phone ring, you freeze. Yeah. Then you go to the window and open up, and just put your eyeball out. And somebody looks up, you jump back. Pain, boy, I mean, despair. And you wake up and say, I got to do it again. And then the saddest part is you're getting drunk, and you can't get drunk no more. And nobody understands you. So I walked into the fellowship. My higher power sent me to a bunch of people. I could say something like, I ate a fly sandwich one day, and somebody in the back would say, thanks for sharing. You know, you really helped me out. I could come into this room and say, I hate all of you. You say, keep coming back. Right? I hate God. Have a cookie. We don't care. Don't drink and make meetings. That's the name of the game. And like Paul and Bonnie said, you know, just stopping drinking isn't the thing. I'm still working on the second half of the first step. And our lives have become unmanageable. I'm still working on that. Every morning I wake up, I pray for the strength to stay sober, to do your will to the best of my ability, not just to do your will. That's a bunch of baloney. You know, because I read all them spiritual books every morning. As soon as I close them, forgot. But I read them anyway. I say my prayer from habit. I was taught, do it from habit. Do it, so I pray every morning from, I don't want to drink. See, I'm a terror when I drink, man. You know, I mean, terror because, forget it, I don't even want to think about it. But I have to keep coming to meetings. So This disease is so powerful. I mean, I've seen a lot of people say, welcome back. But I've seen a lot of people didn't get back. Liz B., who has, I think, 53 years recovery.
Yeah.
You know, she, right? Yeah. She has 53 years, and she says, don't keep coming back. She said, stay.
Right.
You know, I mean, where do I have to go? I remember, you know, them business meetings we have, right, where everybody wants to kill each other, you know, and here, you know, and here we're all like, we love each other, you know. Hi, babe, Mary Jo, oh, hug, hug, hug. You know, the AA hug, 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 you know. And then we have a business meeting. Who are you? Everybody becomes the exodus. And one day when I was doing this chairperson thing, you know, it was a Super Bowl. And I remember telling the group, we're going to cancel the business meeting tonight because of the Super Bowl. And them old timers sat back there real quiet. We can't do that, George. My head spun around like, who are you? I quit. You know, I'm leaving. And you ever like walk and don't have nowhere to go? And they would say, okay, George. You know, they wouldn't yell at you. See, the old timers loved you, man. They loved you till you could love yourself. No criticism. If you thought you was on step 98, they let you stay there. You know? I'm on step 98. I don't know. Okay, Judas, don't drink and make me. See, because they know you didn't know nothing. They knew you didn't know anything. And they gave you time to realize you didn't know nothing. Like I told you, the criticism I had about, I should be up there speaking. You know, and I didn't know what I was talking about. See, but I read the books. So I read all the literature, and I had it. And that helped me to take your inventory. You see? But I'll tell you one of the greatest gifts. I heard a woman say one day, if she didn't have character defects, she wouldn't make meetings. And that's true for me. My character defects stopped me from judging you. So I don't care what I see you doing. I say, man, I done that better. You know, or I done it worse. No criticism. Now, that didn't happen in the beginning. See, I criticized everyone. I remember one time we had a secretary. You ever have somebody in the group you can't stand? You didn't, as soon as they walk in the room, you know, you get that knot in your stomach. Oh, yeah. I call it the relationship knot. You know, like, oh, rejected again, you know. But anyway, we had a secretary, and this guy couldn't stand him, man. And one day I walked up to him, I said, I'm sorry for what I was thinking about you. He said, what are you talking about? I said, please just accept my apology. And then I'm gonna stop with this. I didn't get a sponsor for 5 years, not because I thought I didn't need one. I felt no pain. See, I come in with a lot of walls around me. And when I heard you talk about your failings, I'd say this to myself. I said, they just ain't working the program. They're not doing like I'm doing it. See, I felt no pain. And then one day I was seeing this woman. And we was going to the movies every, you know, like an AA, if you go out for coffee, you're going to get married in your mind. Yeah. Would you like to go to coffee? This is the one. I'm in love again, you know. We're going to be married in 3 weeks, have the house in the country. All they said was, let's go to coffee. But you know how we project. So I'd met this woman, and I was madly in love with her. You know, I've met her about a half hour ago. And I said, would you like to go to the movie? She said, well, no, I'm going with somebody else. And something in my stomach said, So what the heck is that? I didn't know what it was. It was a feeling. I didn't know. Then I asked her the next week. She said, well, no, I'm into something else. What my higher power did, he said, now it's time for this fool to get a sponsor. And this gentleman was coming to this meeting. I was at my sponsor, Richard H. And I thought he was the janitor in this church because he had all these keys, you know. And I didn't know he was a priest because I was anti-religion, you know. And the secretary said, George, your father H called you. I said, who? I said, oh, that's Richard, man. I said, hey, Richard, she called your father. And he said, ha, ha, ha. So I went to the group that night. I said, is he a priest? They said, yes. Yeah. So anyway, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he was the greatest guy. See, I was so rigid. And this is why, like Billy will tell you over there, I'm the lousiest sponsor in the world I have. See, because I don't go to coffee with you. I don't go to dinner. Don't talk to you too much on the phone. I just say, did you drink? See you at the meeting. Bye. That's how I was treated. See, that's how you get what you need. I think we all get what we need. See, I had the sponsor I'd meet every Thursday, and Richard and I would talk. Blah, 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 blah. Now, if I walked out of his office with pain, I wouldn't tell him about it until next Thursday. So doing the fifth step, I just like to say this because he said, I said, Richard, I'm out there, man. I know nobody in there has these problems that I had. I was extremely promiscuous and in pain. I said, the women are coming out the wall at me. He said, you pulling them out? I said, no, I'm not. He said, all right, do a fifth step on it. So I did a 9-page fifth step on it, mailed it to him in the mail with no return address, and then had him read it. So that's how I had to do it. Then he said, maybe you better go to SA. But when I went to SA, everybody was there from AA. So I came back there. I said, the heck with that, man, you know. But that's a true story. That's real. The thing I'm trying to say is, if you're new, if you're coming back, this fellowship works. If you don't believe me, look around you, man. The people here, they're not here like, and they know what the movie's going to be. See, we go to an AME, we know what the movie's going to be. My brother asked me one day, he said, you still go to those meetings? I said, yeah. Okay. You know, and my mother one time cooked a big sweet potato pot, and she put rum flavor in it. And she said, don't give George that. Give him this over here. I don't want to be responsible for him drinking. And if you knew, this is my opinion, then I have to close with this. I don't keep alcohol in my house. See, this is for me. Recovering crack addicts don't keep crack in the house. Well, maybe, you know, maybe company will come over this week and want some crack, you know. A heroin addict don't say, well, a little heroin for them when they come over on the weekend, you know. Maybe hit it a little bit, you know. See, I'm like, this is for me now. See, because if I had a bottle of alcohol and put it behind the cornflakes, one morning I may wake up 3 o'clock and say, I think I'll get a bowl of cornflakes. You know. And I'm going to share this instead of a woman came over to my house one time, and she was beautiful, man. And she had this bag in her hand. And then she took a bottle of wine out the bag. I didn't even look at her. I was like, I said, don't bring no more booze in this house. See, I'm an alcoholic. I don't cook with alcohol. Oh, it'll burn off after 100 degrees. Not me. Hell, I want to drink something with my poison in it. I mean, who's that woman, Snow White? You think she'd eat another apple? No way, man. No way. Poison. See? That's poison. Alcohol is poison to me. I didn't go into the liquor store and say, hey, let me have a bottle of poison, please. Yeah, the top one. Top shelf. Alcohol whipped me bad. Very bad. And I'm thinking, you wouldn't be here if it didn't whip you. You know, I'm extremely grateful, alcoholic, and I'm honored. This bridge back to life, every Sunday I go over that Manhattan Bridge, or the Brooklyn Bridge, or the Williamsburg, and if my car ain't running, the L train, which isn't working now, but we'll work something out. But see, Alcoholic Anonymous saved my life. It gave me my daughter, my son over there who's never seen me drink. It gave me friends. I got my sister over there. I'm just going to say this, my sister Thalma over there, I went by her. I was looking bad one day. It shows you alcohol, and I was like shaking and stuff. I was like feeling bad. And I called her to the job. I said, Thalma, I need a few dollars. And she came out and gave me an envelope. And I was like shaking, and I opened up with $15, and I straightened up. Got me a pack of cigarettes and a pint. Free again. I was happy, you know, because I knew I had that taste. It was like I hit the lottery for $50 million because I had that drink in my hand. Today I don't have to do that. And if nobody told you they love you today, I love you and thank you very much.
Before introducing tonight's speakers, I want to especially thank our speakers committee for their service to this year's dinner. Committee Chair Mary Ann M. and the 8 members of her committee spent many evenings hearing the 51 who were nominated to speak at this dinner. The process requires dedication to service, and I am grateful to the Speakers Committee for their help. And now I would like to introduce our first speaker, Paul M., a member of the Feelings Group from Queens.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have to drink any booze today. I'm very grateful. I'd like to take this opportunity of thanking New York Intergroup for putting on this event, for you people for being here, especially those people that made the trip in for me from Rockaway. And as you probably figured out, I didn't get this accent from drinking Irish whiskey. Although I drank quite a lot of it. I'm from Ireland originally, up in the north near Belfast. And I thank you. And I say that because we Irish have a tendency to talk fast, drunk or sober, you know. It reminds me of the first night I ever spoke at an AA meeting. It was over in Brooklyn at about 90 days. So nervous, right? And I got up there, I took a deep breath, and I spoke for 20 minutes, and I don't think I took another breath. And this half the room is dazed, and this half the room is confused. I think someone thought I was speaking Gaelic, you know. And, you know, they're like, I didn't know they'd wind talkers in Ireland, you know. And but people in AA are so kind. They come up afterwards, and they're like, oh, thank you for sharing. I really got a lot out of what you said. But hopefully it won't be like that tonight. Anyway, hard was what happened and hard is today. I know you have to drink alcohol to be an alcoholic, but I also know that alcohol comes in bottles and alcoholism comes in people. And I had a lot of the symptoms of this disease long before booze ever passed my lips. And back in Northern Ireland as a kid, irritable, discontent, had that stone in my shoe feeling. You know, half measures availed me nothing. So I don't know if I was a symptom looking for disease, but I took the booze like a duck to water. You know, and I was alcoholic from the first drink. You know, as a young kid, 9 or 10 years of age, my father brought me and my brother into a bar in this seaside town in Ireland. We were on our holidays, you know. And he was going to have a few beers with his friends, and me and my brother were going to have a few sodas, right? So that wasn't good enough for me. I go around the tables, and I'm sneaking people's drinks. And the upside is, you know, I got drunk. And this is in a seaside town, and like a vacation town. And they had a talent contest in the bar. And apparently, I got up on the stage, and I sang Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I fell off the stage drunk and had to be carried out of the bar. Now, I could stop my story right there because that's pretty much what happened. Every time I drank, I fell down, and I got carried out. Maybe not the chitty, chitty, bang, bang part. But then again, who knows in a blackout? You know, they go, oh, there goes that Irish guy. Every time he's drunk, he thinks he's Dick Van Dyke, you know? And I believe chitty, chitty, bang, bang is coming back to Broadway. So who knows? Maybe a bridge back to Broadway as well as a bridge back to life, yeah? But as I said, it was like lighting a firecracker when I took drink. And to make matters worse, the neighborhood I grew up in, if you didn't drink, you moved. Everybody drank. I didn't know anybody that didn't drink. And before I was out of my teens, I was I'm not going to go into the whole ins and outs, but I had my stomach pumped out on a school night from drinking when I was like 15. So that gives you some idea where I was going. Before I'm out of my teens, I'm a daily drinker. Before I'm out of my teens, I'm already taking morning drink, you know, and I have a terrible reputation in the neighborhood for drinking. You know, mothers would tell their daughters and their sons, stay away from him. He's bad news when it comes to booze. My parents, I had their hearts broke. And as I said, as I went into my early 20s, my life's just unraveling around me. And I get into the blame game. But I'm from Northern Ireland, and at this stage, Northern Ireland was a crazy place to live in. The troubles were at their height. So I was blaming where I lived and where I didn't live. And this type of stuff. Looking out for the problem instead of in for the solution. And I remember thinking to myself, this country's really stifling my potential. You know what I mean? Now, seriously. You know how you are sitting on a bar stool, you know? I remember thinking to myself, now if I was in America, there's a place a guy like me could really put his best foot forward, you know? And fall flat on his face, right? But, and during one of these drunken epiphanies, I come home and I said to my folks, I'm going to America, and don't you try and talk me out of it. My father's like, talk you out of it, I'll help you pack when you're leaving. On you go, Columbus, you know. Here, I wrapped up a few sandwiches for you and a map, you know. And, I hopped on the only airline to fly if you're an alky, Aer Lingus, Ireland's national airline, believe me. The wheels haven't even left the runway, and already the cabin staff are busting out the drinks cart at the back of the airplane, you know. I'm serious. The plane's at like a 45-degree angle, and the flight attendants are like Sherpas pushing the drinks carts up to the front, you know. And everyone's ringing their bell looking birds, bing, 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 bing. You think you're in a pinball machine rather than an airplane, you know? So anyway, I arrived in New York, and I can see by the crowd here tonight, New York did not need another alcoholic, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, right? These guys are like, listen, any pain, trouble, or misery to be caused to ourselves or anyone else with booze, we got it covered. Thank you very much. But I got here with my 2 cents worth, and like driftwood, I washed up in Rockaway Beach. Now, you talk about going from the frying pan to the fire. You tell people you live in Rockaway Beach, they go, oh, Rockaway Beach, the Irish Riviera. It's more like cirrhosis by the sea, you know? There's two types of people in Rockaway, those in AA and those that should be in AA, you know? And there's notable exceptions, one of them being my wife here tonight, so let me get that in. So, and to make matters worse, I got a job as a bartender. Now, I'm using the word bar here in the loosest possible context. I mean, this was a real dive. It was a sort of a bar you got thrown into rather than out of, you know? And this is where I would eventually acquire the title of being the worst bartender in the worst bar in Rockaway. And believe me, that was from a highly competitive field, you know what I mean? I mean, this bar had it all, I'm not kidding you. Alcoholics, drug addicts, degenerate gamblers, and that was just the staff, that wasn't even the customers. I mean, now and again, I get a moment of clarity. What's a nice guy like me doing a place like this, you know? This wasn't in the brochure when I decided to come to America, you know? But it's where I belong because it's so true. The non-alcoholic will change their life to meet their goals. An alcoholic will change his goals to meet his life. So I was right where I belonged. I fitted in like a glove. You know, and my drinking really took off. You know, I used to work at night. So I'm drinking before work. I'm drinking at work. I'm drinking after work. And, you know, that's a story of my alcoholism. It got progressively worse. I start hitting hospitals. I'm having convulsions and seizures. And things just got worse. And people be on to me about my drinking. And I used to think about it. You know, people said, Paul, why are you drinking like you're drinking? You know, because, and I would have said, lack of willpower. But more willpower, I could have half a dozen drinks and go home. Or my ace in the hole was punishment from God. He's headed in for me from day one. I fancied myself like some sort of modern day Job, you know, and I was on top of God's vendetta list on a daily basis. But like our book says, truth be known, I really had no idea why I was drinking. Here I am working as a bartender. I know all about alcohol, but I don't know anything about alcoholism. I don't know it's the first drink gets you drunk. I don't realize I got a body that won't let me drink and a mind that won't let me stop, that I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life's unmanageable, drunk or sober when I'm running it, and I'm the only person running it. I didn't know any of this stuff until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I had pretty much experienced every form of drinking. Daily drinking, morning drinking, binge drinking. But the drinking that caught up with me, the last few years, I became a periodic alcoholic. I was either on around-the-clock drunk or a white-knuckle dry. And the drunks got longer in duration, and the period between them got shorter. And it was bad. Now, I got sober in August. And in the early part of that summer, I'd put two really bad drunks together, almost back-to-back. And that shook me up. And I managed to stay dry till August, and then I busted out drinking again. And I went at it for about 3 weeks round the clock. At this stage, very little barroom drinking, round the clock at home, not eating, you know, not washing, suicidal type drinking. And I was in bad shape and I knew it. Now, Susan, who's my wife, we all have our miracle stories and here's mine. Susan, who's my wife, she stood by, I mean, we weren't married then, but she stood by me. And, you know, Dr. Bob said we're blessed with great women and I can certainly attest to that. And she didn't know if I was alive or dead because I was AWOL. I wouldn't answer the phone, wouldn't answer the door. And she's at work and very upset. And a friend of hers at work said, my father's got a friend who's in AA. And she gave him his number. So this, through this convoluted chain of events, she wrote the number down and put it under my door with a note which had been saying what I've been hearing since I was 15. You're a nice guy, but you drink too much. And I was in so much pain that I picked up the phone and I called a complete stranger. And he had been primed that I was going to call. And this guy had been in AA since 1961. And I said to him, I can't stop drinking. He says, you can't stop drinking because you're an alcoholic. And immediately I'm thinking to myself, how dare this guy call me an alcoholic? He doesn't even know me. You know what I mean? I mean, the pride and ego of the alcoholic is unbelievable. I'm laying in the gutter looking down on people. You know what I'm saying? And I bit my tongue and he says, do you believe in God? And I come out with the old, yeah, but he doesn't believe in me type thing. He says, well, say a quick prayer and I'm coming over to your house. And I hung up the phone. It was a hot August morning. I'm drinking whiskey and beer. And this thought came into my head, what have I got to lose? Because I realized I had made booze my higher power. I had held it up like a deity. It was going to be the solution to all my problems. And here I am sitting in my apartment, emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually bankrupt. That was the return on my investment of me running the show. And I said, what have I got to lose? So for the first time in years, with any degree of authenticity, I got down on my knees and I said, if there's anything out there, please help me. And it was a hot August morning, but it really was a cry in the dark. And I'm glad that God is not a scorekeeper, because immediately I felt like someone just took a big weight off my shoulders. And a great sense of peace came over me. And I started to worry and fret, but this other feeling just kept suppressing it, that I'm sitting on the floor totally at peace. And this other thought came into my head, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. Now, I know I didn't put those thoughts there. I'm not an expert in these matters, but I think at that moment in time, I surrendered totally. I let go absolutely of all my old ideas. And by acknowledging that I was totally helpless, I ceased being totally hopeless. And just after that, the guy, Jerry, came to the door and I told him what happened. He said, you had a spiritual experience, it'll get you sober, but it won't keep you sober. We've got to get you to AA. I was too sick to go there, but 4 days later, I was strong enough to go to my first meeting of AA, and it was the greatest thing I ever did. Even scrambled eggs as I was, I knew at that first meeting there was something here. Susan met me after my first meeting, and she had heard all before, the promises and the oaths and the diatribe. And I told her I found something. I intuitively knew. I couldn't have described it. I couldn't have written it down, but I knew there was something here. And boy, did I only know the half of it. Because, see, I would have settled for not drinking, just get the disease off my back. But I got so much more besides. I got me back, I got you back, and I got him back. And I'd lost a whole lot. So for about the first 2.5 years, I threw myself into the fellowship and the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though I had that spiritual experience, I really only took a cautionary glance at steps 2 and 3. And I reached a point 2.5 years into AA where I don't know if I was going to drink, but I certainly wasn't a picture of serenity. And it came at a point I realized that there was a need for a second surrender. Yes, I had surrendered to booze, but now I had to surrender to life on life's terms. And for me, that meant not just abandoning myself to God, but to the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, this program or aspects of it is totally alien to my personality. Irish, stoic, stuff everything, don't tell nobody nothing. That was my code of conduct, but that was getting me absolutely nowhere in here. See, I was still operating under that old barroom mentality. You know, I wanted you to do the steps and I'll feel better. You know, and AA doesn't work that way. You know, you get through the door and a gift, but everything else you got to work for, right? What's the old saying? There's no free lunches in AA. I know what you're thinking. There's no free dinners either. And you're probably right, you know. And so I reached that point. Now, the people told me, Paul, it's a program of attraction, not promotion. You got to make that decision. And this is my own opinion. I know this is a worldwide fellowship, but I don't think it's any coincidence that it started here in the States. Because this thing is as American as apple pie. It's democratic. It's egalitarian. It's inclusive. But most of all, it gives and respects your freedom. In other words, the guys told me, Paul, you decide how high you want to fly in this program. You make that decision. Step one's an important step, but it's just the beginning of the journey. If you elect to stay there, you will be unhappy, miserable, and discontent because you're going to be sitting there with untreated alcoholism. But if you want to do that, go ahead, knock yourself out, and you probably will. But if you want to have these promises realized in your life, if you want to know peace and happiness and serenity, well then take this journey with us. But you must make that decision because this program is not for people that need it, nor is it for people that want it. It's for people that do it. So you decide what you want to do. You see, the pain of drinking had drove me into the fellowship, and the pain of living in this fellowship without the entire program drove me into the steps. And thank God I went on faith rather than reason. And I realized that we don't do the steps because they're nice. We do them because they're necessary for recovery. Now, I'm not saying the steps were the panacea for everything, but they brought me to a point in recovery where I could decide what was my work, what was God's work, and where I needed outside help. And believe me, I don't do it perfect. There's days I'm sober and there's other days I don't drink. But because I stayed around here and eventually did the work, I know the difference. And by doing that program, I was eventually able to do something that I was unwilling or unable to do before in the past. And that was live life on life's terms. That bridge back to life. You see, I'm in here because I can't live out there. I can't live out there drunk. I tried that. Booze failed me. I can't live out there without this entire program. Tried that. Stark raving sober. The only chance I have of living out there is this program, fellowship, and a God of my understanding working together on this 24-hour plan, this design for living, this recovery package, wherein this hopeless alcoholic can stay off booze for one day and hopefully be a better man. That's what works for me, you know. And as I said, this is what I try to do. And that's what I like about AA, because it's a reality check on a daily basis. Not what life should be, not what I think it should be, but how it is today. This is where the rubber meets the road. You see, I wasn't a big fan of reality. It's no coincidence I'm standing here in the middle of New York with an Irish accent. I was a runner, a long-distance runner, and booze. I was an escape artist, and booze was a great escape. But by doing that program, I was able to realize why I put the running shoes on. And even in sobriety, realized that every time I ran away from life, I was the guy firing the starting pistol. You see, this is the real deal in here. I mean, this is my own opinion again. For me, drinking booze was the closest thing to a spiritual experience that actually wasn't one. I mean, it was so close, but it wasn't the real deal. You know that half-drunk feeling where you're sitting like, I wanted to live there 24/7, and that's not reality. And looking back on it, any victory that I had was purely symbolic and short-lived. The real deal was in here. You see, there was always that desire within me to be spiritually complete. I ended up with a hole in my soul, and I tried to fill it with booze and people and places and things, all this stuff from the outside. When I eventually worked that program, I was able to make that spiritual connection, able to tap into that spirituality. More will be revealed. I was able to find out that I didn't need those outside props, that phrase, happiness is an inside job, is not some trite throwaway phrase. There's a lot of truth in that, because the spirituality was always here, you know, and I was able to tap into it. Like that old phrase, a bird doesn't fly because it has wings, it has wings because it flies. The spirituality was always here, and I was able to work it. You know, and as I said, I don't do it perfect, but I got used people to help me. Because we do together what I can't do alone. They told me, never underestimate the power of the first word of the first step. Because this beautiful fellowship that we can trace right back to the co-founder, Bill Wilson. When he had that blessed idea, I wonder if I can get sober by trying to help another alcoholic get sober. The turning point in all our lives, past and present. Because out of that thought would come a fellowship and a program where people like me would be forced to do things that they normally wouldn't do, and in doing so, be brought into the sunlight of the Spirit. So I owe a debt of gratitude to those early pioneers, because before Bill Wilson, there wasn't much hope for us. Jails, institutions, or death. And once you've been locked up a few times and strapped down a few times, believe me, death starts to look like a viable option. You know, and those early guys, I mean, even the public perception of us was horrendous. We were the world's weakling, the alcoholic. I can stop whenever I want, why can't he? I wish I had a dollar for every time I heard that. We were society's first outcast, a drunkard. Stay away from him. He's bad news when it comes to booze. Because of those early pioneers, Bill Wilson included, this disease was finally dragged out of the dark ages and into the modern era. And it was all just here for me when I got here. I haven't had an original thought since I got to AA. That's the God's honest truth. I work in education, and believe me, thank God this is one learning center where copying is encouraged and plagiarism is allowed. Because it's really been see it done and then do it yourself, you know. And as I said, I'm no longer alone because I got used people. You know, I don't know your whole life story, but when you tell me you're an alcoholic, I know enough. I know that you've experienced terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. I know you put a drink to your lips as the tears rolled down your face and you drank it anyway. I know that friends and family and loved ones pleaded with you not to drink and you drank. I know you drank when you're mad, sad, glad, didn't know why you got started and couldn't stop once you did. I know these things because you tell me you're an alcoholic. I know these things because I'm an alcoholic. But I'll tell you something I don't know. I don't know why we are here and other people aren't. Because most alcoholics die drunk. I guarantee you right now, not too far from this hotel, somebody's drinking themselves to death. And they'll never get to a meeting of AA. They'll never get a 30-day chip. They'll never blow the candle off a one-year anniversary cake. And they'll die the terrible death of an active alcoholic. Pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And they'll live out the last years of their existence under the mad realm of King Alcohol. And we know from our own experience that that's not exaggeration or hyperbole. Because that's the way it is. Because that's the way it was with us. I know that road myself. I was on it. You know, I paid myself with the stones of self-deception, self-destruction, self-will, all the way to the end, where I'm sitting in my apartment, drinking round the clock, against my own will, knowing loneliness that only an alcoholic can know. Life with drink terrified me. Life without drink terrified me. The jumping off place, wishing for the end. And to tell you the truth, I didn't really care if I went over the edge, because that's what booze will do to you. It will remove the will to live. But somebody did cure. God in his infinite wisdom says, no, you're not going over the edge. You're not going into the abyss. And he put me on a different road. And my book tells me the road I'm on today, the road of happy destiny. It even tells me who I'm going to meet, use people. It even tells me what we're going to do, trudge, walk with purpose. There's a purpose to my life today. There's a rhythm. There's a meaning. I'm not sitting somewhere in my cups wondering, what's it all about? I know what it's about. Because I know that I am Paul and I am an alcoholic. And that tells me who I am and what I am and where I need to be. And if I know that, I'm all right. And when I'm all right, everything around me is all right too. So AA allowed me to get all right because it allowed me to come to terms with the past so I could live in the present for the future, which is the rest of today. You know, AA gave me the ability to live two lives in one lifetime. I was on the scrap heap at 16 because of drink. I came into AA just to stop drinking and eventually became responsible, accountable, married Susan. We got a beautiful stepdaughter. Last year we were blessed with a baby ourselves who's hopefully sleeping up in her room right now, but I doubt it very much, you know. She's probably sitting watching Dora the Explorer. And what the heck, we're all up late tonight, you know. And, I'm back to school, got a degree, got a master's. And June I'll be finished my second master's. Did I say I just came here to stop drinking? The gifts of this program are endless. You know what? But that's all. I'm Irish. That's all ice cream. The meat and potatoes, one, I don't drink. Two, I don't have to drink. Three, I don't want to drink because I found something better than drink. The big headline for me in AA is there's life after booze. You know? So, and it's a good life too. So if you're just coming around or you're just coming back, there's a miracle here with your name on it. Please don't leave here without it. You know, every day in AA is great. Some days are greater than others. And this is certainly one of those greater days. It's an honor and a privilege to be allowed to come here tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope with each and every one of you. And I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for letting me share. And that's all I'll say. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Paul.